Imagine you're the head of a massive federal agency. It's like 6 in the morning on a Tuesday.
You're just waking up, probably.
Right. You're standing in your kitchen, you're drinking your first cup of coffee, and your phone buzzes.
Just a normal morning.
Exactly. You glance down, and in 140 characters, the President of the United States has just completely reversed your department's core mission.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, there were no internal memos, there was no, extensive legal review process, your deputies weren't briefed.
Nothing.
Just a public tweet blasted out to tens of millions of people while you were still figuring out how to use the coffee maker.
Which is just, I mean, it's wild.
It really is. And that's our focus today, because today we're looking at what happens when the ultimate outsider is handed the keys to the world's most complex bureaucratic machine.
And then decides to just, fundamentally bypass the entire operating system.
Exactly. Welcome to today's deep dive. I am so glad you're joining us for this one, because today our mission is to explore a truly fascinating historical overview.
It's a great one.
We are pulling directly from our source material, Dossier Trump 2015-2029. And specifically, we are going to focus all our energy on Chapter 2.
Right, which covers the period from 2017 to 2021.
Yes, the era of redefining the presidency. And to set the stage for you listening right now, we are dealing with a totally unique baseline here.
Totally unique.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because what actually happens when someone with zero military experience and absolutely zero administrative government experience just takes the helm?
Well, it is the absolute definition of a systemic shock. I mean, a stress test of the highest order.
Right.
Because traditionally, when we talk about a transition of presidential power, there's this expectation of a highly synchronized choreography.
Like a dance.
Yeah, or like a massive symphony orchestra. It's designed to seamlessly pass the baton to a new conductor.
The sheet music is already printed.
Exactly. The musicians know their parts perfectly. The new conductor just steps up to the podium and maybe adjusts the tempo a little bit to fit their style.
It's seamless. Seamless and almost boring by design.
And boring is good, right? In a global superpower, boring means stable.
Exactly. But then you look at what happened on January 20th, 2017, and suddenly that whole orchestra metaphor just completely falls apart.
It shatters.
Right. We aren't looking at a simple change in management. We are looking at a fundamental tearing up of the sheet music itself.
And to really understand the gravity of that experiment, we have to look closely at the inheritance. Like, what exactly was handed over to him on that January morning?
Right. The inheritance is key because Trump inherited this fascinating, highly volatile paradox.
Paradox how?
Well, on the one hand, he was handed the keys to a remarkably robust economy.
True.
He inherited a massive, highly structured civil service apparatus numbering in the millions.
The bureaucracy.
Right. And perhaps most significantly, he inherited a global security and trade structure that the U.S. had painstakingly built since 1945.
So immense global power, all just sitting right there in the Oval Office.
Exactly. The levers were all there. But that's only half the picture.
Right, because if you were following the news during this time, you probably remember it feeling like just a blur of constant breaking news.
Is exhausting.
Yeah, escalating tensions everywhere. Because the other side of that paradox is the internal state of the country itself.
Precisely. He inherited a deeply, deeply fractured nation.
And this wasn't a sudden division, right? It didn't just magically materialize on election night.
No, not at all. It was characterized by a years-long, steadily growing distrust of the federal government.
And the media.
Yes, a deepening distrust of traditional media, and just this profound resentment toward political and financial elites.
So the ground was already shaking before he even took the oath of office.
It was. And his presidency would ultimately serve to both, amplify and accelerate these exact underlying developments.
And that is exactly what we are going to explore. For you listening right now, we are going to take a completely impartial look at how this presidency didn't just change policies.
It redefined the office itself.
Right. So let's start with the most immediate visible shock to the system. How the commander-in-chief actually spoke to the public.
The ultimate disruption, governing without a filter.
Yeah, it's the perfect place to start because communication is the literal lifeblood of any administration.
It really is. And to appreciate the shock, we have to look at the pre-Trump baseline.
How it used to be done.
Exactly. For decades, previous presidents relied on incredibly rigid, highly structured channels.
You're talking about the press conferences.
Right. Formal press conferences in the briefing room.
Yeah.
Official, carefully drafted, written statements.
Meticulously prepared press secretaries.
Yes, briefing the White House press corps daily. and you had formal sit-down interviews with major networks.
It was this entire ecosystem of vetting. I mean, every single word a president said was legally reviewed.
Legally reviewed, politically calibrated, strategically timed by teams of communication experts.
Before it ever reached the public ear.
Exactly. The process was the point. But Trump completely bypassed that machinery.
He used Twitter.
He used Twitter. And he didn't just use it occasionally to post, like, holiday greetings.
No, no. He used it to speak directly, daily, and sometimes hourly to tens of millions of people.
The dossier highlights this as a completely new form of presidential leadership. It wasn't just a change in the medium.
Right. It wasn't just moving from a podium to a smartphone.
No, it was a change in the velocity and the origin of federal policy.
And this is where that 6 a.m. coffee scenario comes in. Because the sources highlight a staggering detail that honestly, it blows my mind every time I think about it.
The policy announcements.
Yes. Entire national policies were often announced on social media before the relevant government ministries were even informed.
Think about the physical reality of that.
You have high-level civil servants, four-star generals, people running massive federal departments, literally refreshing their social media feeds.
Just to find out about sweeping structural changes to their own departments?
It completely upended the traditional chain of command.
It did. Because if you look at the mechanics of how the federal government operates, it relies on a cascade of memos, you know.
Legal clearances, implementation guidelines.
Right. And a sudden tweet declaring a new tariff or a sudden military withdrawal just circumvented all of that.
It's like a corporate CEO suddenly deciding to fire the entire PR department.
And the HR department.
Right. And the legal team. And deciding instead to just text all the millions of shareholders directly from his bed at 2 a.m.
Hey, guys, we are completely changing our core product tomorrow.
Good luck to the factory managers figuring it out.
It's a very apt analogy. The shockwaves through the organization are impossible to overstate.
So let's examine the logical merits of both sides here to understand why this was so polarizing.
Okay.
If you look at this through the lens of a supporter, this approach was what? A breath of fresh air?
A massive breath of fresh air.
Yeah.
It was seen as unprecedented radical transparency.
Because they felt connected.
Exactly. For the first time in modern history, voters felt they had direct, unfiltered contact with their leader.
There was no spin room.
No pundits translating what the president, quote unquote, meant to say. It allowed for incredibly fast communication.
And to his base, it was a brilliant way to cut out what they saw as the media middleman.
Right, the middleman who would otherwise selectively edit or twist his words.
The appeal was the raw authenticity of it. Even if it was messy, it felt real.
It felt very real to them.
But if you sit in the critic's chair looking at those exact same tweets, you see a completely different reality.
Entirely different. Critics look at this direct-to-consumer phenomenon and saw a severe systemic danger.
Because of the impulsivity.
Yes. They pointed out that this approach led to highly impulsive decision-making.
Since these statements weren't legally vetted.
Right. It caused massive confusion about what actual legally binding policy was versus what was just a late night thought.
Or a negotiation tactic.
Exactly. It led to the spread of incorrect or contradictory information directly from the highest office in the land.
And arguably, most worryingly for the diplomatic establishment, it created severe unpredictability on the international stage.
Oh, absolutely.
Think about the global ramifications. If we have an ambassador sitting in an embassy in Europe, and they are suddenly hauled in by a foreign government
to explain a tweet that the president sent 5 minutes ago.
They have zero briefing materials. They are flying completely blind.
Foreign allies and adversaries alike didn't know if a social media post was a formal declaration of U.S. foreign policy.
Or just a personal grievance being aired.
Exactly. So if we connect this to the bigger picture, the objective takeaway from the dossier is profound.
Trump permanently rewrote the communication rulebook.
He did. Love it or hate it. Direct social media communication that completely bypasses traditional institutional channels is now an indispensable tool in modern politics.
He proved the filter could be removed.
And he proved that the algorithmic amplification of social media,
which rewards impulse and controversy.
Right. It rewards strong emotion over nuanced policy papers. He proved that could be harnessed for immense political power.
And once that genie's out of the bottle, subsequent leaders can't just put it back.
No, you can't just rely solely on dry written press releases anymore.
But, you know, this direct-to-consumer strategy naturally triggers a massive counter-reaction.
Of course it does.
Because if you're a president who has decided to completely bypass the traditional media and use social media to actively discredit them...
The traditional media is going to fight back.
Exactly. And that friction escalates from a standard political rivalry into an outright media war.
A total war.
We go from viewing the press as the fourth estate watchdog to explicitly labeling them an, quote-unquote, enemy.
It's a crucial historic escalation. Now, we do need to acknowledge the historical context here.
Because tension with the press isn't new.
Right. Natural tension between journalists and the Oval Office is as old as the Republic itself.
Thomas Jefferson complained about newspapers.
Bitterly. He wrote that the man who never looks into a newspaper is better informed than he who reads them.
Wow. And Richard Nixon had a famously toxic relationship with the press corps.
So it's a built-in constitutional dynamic designed to ensure accountability.
But the source material makes it abundantly clear. Trump took this inherent tension to a completely unprecedented level.
He weaponized it.
Yeah.
He didn't just dodge tough questions. He introduced new terms into the global lexicon.
Terms we still hear every single day.
Right. Fake news.
And the heavier one, calling the press the enemy of the people.
That specific phrasing is what shifted the tectonic plates.
How so?
Well, applying the phrase enemy of the people to mainstream media outlets moved the dynamic from adversarial to existential.
It wasn't just saying these reporters are biased.
No, it was saying these reporters are actively trying to destroy the country.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because he didn't just pull this strategy out of thin air, right?
No, he didn't.
The dossier points out that Trump did not invent distrust in the media.
He absolutely did not. A large, growing portion of Americans already deeply distrusted national media outlets long before 2015.
It was a pre-existing sentiment.
Backed by years of polling. There was this feeling that national journalism was increasingly concentrated in affluent coastal bubbles.
Completely disconnected from the everyday realities of citizens in the middle of the country.
Exactly. To use a metaphor, the media landscape had become this massive echo chamber.
Where the acoustics were designed to only amplify existing grievances.
Right. The dry tinder of distrust was already stacked 10 feet high in the forest.
He just brought the match.
That's a very accurate way to frame the mechanism at play. His message was incredibly simple and highly effective.
The media does not represent you. They represent an out-of-touch, corrupt elite.
He tapped into an existing grievance and handed it a megaphone.
So let's look at how this functioned practically. For the supporters of the administration, how did this fake news framing actually operate as a political tool?
For the supporters, this rhetoric was wildly successful as a defensive shield.
It reinforced their trust in him.
Exactly. By systematically discrediting the traditional media institutions, Trump positioned himself as the sole reliable narrator of his own presidency.
So if a major news outlet reported something negative,
like an investigative piece on his businesses or a leak from within the White House,
his base was already perfectly primed to dismiss it entirely.
Right, to dismiss it as fake news manufactured by the elite to bring him down.
It created an incredibly resilient, almost impenetrable political armor.
It really did. But if we look at it from the critic's perspective, this wasn't just savvy political defense.
It was an attack on reality itself.
Precisely. Opponents and critics saw this rhetoric as a terrifying direct threat to the First Amendment and press freedom.
They viewed an independent press as a foundational pillar of democracy.
So when the president routinely labels journalists the enemy of the people, critics argued it wasn't just political theater.
They argued it was dangerously eroding the public's shared sense of objective reality.
Undermining the very concept of verifiable facts.
And in some cases, putting journalists in actual physical danger at rallies and protests.
Exactly.
So the big takeaway here is that while Trump didn't create the underlying lack of trust in media institutions, his unique innovation was making that distrust the central pillar of his entire strategy.
Right. He didn't just complain that the referees were making bad calls.
He convinced half the stadium that the referees were actively rigging the game.
And therefore, the only person they should trust for the score was him.
Which is wild, yeah. And that external war over who controls the narrative naturally bleeds right into the internal workings of his administration.
It definitely does.
Because if the president is bypassing his own government's communication channels on Twitter and fighting a daily war with the press...
What on earth is happening inside the West Wing?
Right. The dossier spends a lot of time on this internal chaos, this clash between the established bureaucracy and the concept of the deep state.
The internal dynamics were characterized by what the dossier describes as a historically high turnover rate.
It was a revolving door at the absolute highest levels of the federal government.
The numbers are staggering when you look back at the timeline.
We aren't just talking about mid-level staffers moving on after a couple of years.
No, we are talking about a constant churn of the most critical, sensitive roles in the executive branch.
Chiefs of staff, communications directors, national security advisors.
And then confirmed cabinet ministers.
People who normally hold these posts for 4 years were sometimes gone in months.
Or even weeks.
So to understand why this happened, we have to look at the root causes, right?
Right. We have to look at the mechanics of the federal government versus the mechanics of a private real estate empire.
The source materia lists a convergence of factors. First, fundamentally clashing management styles.
You have a president accustomed to running a privately held family business.
Where his word is final, immediate, and unquestioned.
And that clashes head on with the slow, procedural, heavily legalistic reality of the federal government.
Which is bound by laws like the Administrative Procedure Act. Let's explain that a bit more for the listeners.
Sure.
The civil service isn't just a bunch of people who work for the president, right? They are protected by laws.
Exactly. Ever since the Pendleton Act in the 1880s, the vast majority of federal workers are nonpartisan career civil servants.
They are hired based on merit, not political affiliation.
And they are extremely difficult to fire.
Because they're designed to be the institutional memory of the country.
Ensuring the government keeps functioning regardless of who is in the Oval Office.
They move deliberately. They require impact studies.
Limited overview.
And that deliberate, slow pace collided violently with a president who demanded immediate action.
Which leads to the second major cause of the turnover.
The premium placed on personal loyalty.
Yes. Intense personal loyalty to the president, which often overrode loyalty to the institution.
Or to standard operating procedures.
Correct. When you had a clash between procedural norms and a demand for immediate loyalty, the result is vicious internal power struggles.
Because if the currency of the realm inside the White House is personal loyalty.
And proximity to the president.
You get factions constantly forming and reforming.
You had advisors actively leaking damaging information to the press.
The exact same press the president is at war with.
Right. In order to backstab each other and gain influence.
And finally, you had a general inexperience in traditional governance among many of the initial appointees.
When you put all those factors together.
A CEO mindset demands for personal loyalty, infighting, lack of procedural knowledge.
A high turnover rate isn't just likely, it's almost mathematically inevitable.
But this internal friction gave rise to a very specific, highly potent narrative. The concept of the deep state.
Ah, yes. The deep state.
Where did that term even come from?
Well, it originated in countries with powerful shadow military intelligence apparatuses. Places like Turkey or Egypt.
But Trump imported it.
He imported it and adapted it to the American context. It became his framing of himself as a lone crusader.
Positioned against a bloated bureaucracy.
Against federal agencies like the FBI and the DOJ.
He painted the permanent civil service not as impartial workers, but as a shadow government.
A shadow government actively, maliciously trying to sabotage his presidency.
It's a fascinating rhetorical pivot. It takes the routine bureaucratic resistance.
The natural slow-moving inertia of a massive government.
And rebrands it as a coordinated treasonous conspiracy against the democratically elected leader.
Exactly.
But wait, let me play devil's advocate here for a second, or at least pose a question from the outside looking in.
Okay, go ahead.
Could this massive turnover and this relentless attack on the bureaucracy be viewed as a feature rather than a bug?
How do you mean?
I mean, was he just applying a ruthless Silicon Valley startup mentality to a 200-year-old bureaucratic machine?
The move fast and break things approach.
Yeah. If you're explicitly elected to disrupt the establishment, don't you have to fire the people who actively refuse to disrupt?
That is exactly how his supporters viewed it.
Yeah.
You've perfectly articulated the defense.
Really?
Yeah, for the base, this wasn't chaos. It was the promised draining of the swamp.
They cheered on the public firings.
They did. They saw it as the president actively cleaning out a stagnant, self-serving bureaucratic system that had forgotten the working class.
To them, he was swiftly removing unelected officials who were working against his agenda.
If an official pushed back on a policy citing norms, firing them was seen as strong, decisive leadership.
You're fired. I mean, it was his famous catchphrase on reality television before he even got into politics.
Exactly. So seeing it applied to Washington insiders felt like a massive promise kept.
But the critics, of course, saw a completely different, much darker reality.
They did. Critics pointed to the massive administrative chaos it caused.
They argued you fundamentally cannot run a nuclear-armed superpower like a tech startup.
Right. They pointed to a dangerous lack of continuity. When you constantly cycle through national security advisors or secretaries of defense,
you lose vital strategic momentum.
Foreign allies don't know who to trust or call.
Furthermore, they highlighted a severe loss of institutional expertise.
When career diplomats, scientists, and intelligence experts are driven out, you lose decades of collective memory.
Ultimately, critics argued that this high turnover fundamentally undermined public trust in vital government agencies.
It did.
So, synthesizing all of this, the internal mechanics of this period were defined by an exceptionally dynamic, incredibly volatile administrative culture.
It meant that while the president could flawlessly dominate the daily news cycle with a single tweet,
actually, executing consistent long-term policy through the federal apparatus became incredibly difficult.
The operating system was constantly crashing because the new software was incompatible.
The engine was constantly being taken apart and put back together while the car was driving down the highway at 100 miles an hour.
Exactly.
And that systemic friction, it was all building massive pressure. And it eventually reached a spectacular boiling point in 2019.
The ultimate friction.
Their first impeachment.
This was a deeply consequential moment in American history.
To understand it, we need to look at the factual timeline laid out in the dossier.
Right. In the summer of 2019, a major controversy erupted surrounding a phone call
between President Trump and the newly elected president of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky.
And it's vital to note that this wasn't a standard policy dispute about tax rates or health care.
No, this was fundamentally about the use or alleged abuse of the raw power of the presidency.
The mechanics of what happened are crucial. Critics, prompted by a whistleblower complaint from within the intelligence community.
That same deep state bureaucracy we just discussed.
Right. They allege that Trump leveraged his presidential power by intentionally withholding nearly $400 million in congressionally approved military aid to Ukraine.
And why did he withhold it?
The allegation was that he withheld this critical assistance to force Ukraine into publicly announcing a corruption investigation into Joe Biden.
Who was his primary domestic political opponent ahead of the 2020 election?
Exactly. And that specific allegation triggered the absolute most severe constitutional emergency process available.
The House of Representatives formally opened an impeachment inquiry.
We really need to pause and detail the historical gravity of this.
It's so easy in the modern news cycle to get numb to breaking news alerts, but this is staggering.
By voting to impeach him, the House made Donald Trump only the third U.S. president in history to face this.
Over two centuries out of 45 presidents, only Andrew Johnson, Bill Clinton, and Donald Trump.
It is the ultimate emergency break built into the Constitution.
Now, he was subsequently tried in the Senate and acquitted.
Because neither side could muster the two-thirds majority required for actual removal from office.
The vote fell almost entirely along strict party lines.
But what the dossier emphasizes is what this impeachment truly signified beyond the legal outcome.
It was the ultimate mirror held up to the country.
It reflected exactly how deep and how impenetrable America's political divisions had become.
It was a literal litmus test for reality. Let's look at how the two halves of the country viewed this exact same set of facts.
The split was absolute and irreconcilable.
To Trump's base, what was it?
To his supporters, this entire impeachment process was the ultimate proof of a political witch hunt.
It validated everything he had been telling them.
They saw it as the deep state, the media, and the establishment illegally weaponizing the Constitution to undo the 2016 election.
They believe the establishment was terrified of an outsider who threatened their power.
For them, the fact that he was acquitted in the Senate was seen as total undeniable vindication.
But to the opponents, to the critics.
To the critics, this was an absolutely necessary, urgent, and morally required exercise of constitutional oversight.
They viewed the withholding of taxpayer-funded military aid for a personal political favor as a textbook abuse of power.
And a profound betrayal of national security.
To them, the acquittal wasn't vindication at all.
No, it was tragic proof that partisan tribal loyalty had completely superseded the rule of law.
It's incredible to think about. The exact same event, viewed through two completely different prisms, flawlessly confirming the pre-existing beliefs of both sides.
It really sets the stage for the domestic landscape.
But the disruption didn't stay inside the borders of the United States. And that brings us to the global stage.
Rewriting the global rulebook.
Because if you have a leader who is entirely willing to break all the unwritten norms in Washington, they are certainly going to break them in Brussels and Beijing.
And he did, with extraordinary speed.
To appreciate the scale of this geopolitical disruption, remind us of the global baseline he inherited.
Well, ever since the ashes of World War II, U.S. foreign policy rested on a few immutable core pillars.
Regardless of whether a Democrat or a Republican was in the White House.
Exactly. It was called the Liberal International Order. It relied on building strong, permanent alliances.
Fostering multilateral cooperation.
And building up massive international institutions like the UN, the WTO, and NATO.
The unifying theory was that a stable, rules-based order was the best way to secure American prosperity and prevent another world war.
Right. And then comes the new doctrine. Two words that changed everything.
America first.
Trump's America first doctrine violently disrupted that 70-year consensus.
It explicitly rejected the idea of the liberal international order.
The new rule was shockingly simple and highly transactional. American interests must unconditionally take precedence in every single bilateral interaction.
If a trade deal or a military alliance doesn't immediately visibly benefit the U.S. right now,
it's a bad deal and we should walk away.
It was a massive philosophical shift.
It moved from viewing global alliances as long-term strategic investments to viewing them as short-term financial contracts where the U.S. was being ripped off.
And the diplomatic fallout with historic allies was immediate. The list of institutions that came under sudden pressure is staggering.
Historic NATO relationships were strained to the breaking point.
He aggressively demanded members pay more for their own defense. He even publicly questioned the core Article 5 commitment.
And just as a quick refresher, Article 5 is an attack on one is an attack on all mutual defense clause.
It forms the very beating heart of the NATO alliance. Questioning it sent shockwaves through Europe.
Beyond that, historic trade agreements like NAFTA were torn up and renegotiated into the USMCA.
He pulled the U.S. entirely out of international climate pacts like the Paris Agreement.
The European reaction is particularly fascinating here. The dossier notes that for the first time in decades, European leaders had this profound realization.
They had to seriously discuss the concept of strategic autonomy.
They realized, to their horror, that they could no longer completely guarantee that Washington would always have their back in a crisis.
So they began discussions on building their own independent defense capacity.
And independent supply chains to become less reliant on the U.S. That is a massive generational geopolitical earthquake.
So we see the disruption with European allies, but we really need to look east. Because the shift on China is arguably the single most consequential foreign policy legacy of this era.
Absolutely. It fundamentally altered the 21st century.
Previous administrations generally viewed China through the lens of economic integration, right?
Right. The prevailing theory for decades was that by trading heavily with China, bringing them into the WTO, they would gradually liberalize their economy.
Open their society and become a responsible stakeholder in the global system.
Trump completely forcefully abandoned that theory.
He shifted the official U.S. view of China from a necessary trading partner to a direct economic, technological, and strategic adversary.
And the discussion in our sources covers the key flashpoints that drove this shift. He didn't just talk about democracy.
He pointed to raw economics. He pointed to massive trade deficits, arguing China was actively hollowing out American manufacturing.
He aggressively highlighted state-sponsored intellectual property theft.
He focused heavily on technology dominance, specifically the race to control 5G networks, semiconductors, and artificial intelligence.
And crucially, long before anyone else was talking about it,
yeah.
He pointed out the severe national security danger of relying entirely on China for domestic production capacity of critical goods.
This entire strategic shift culminated in a massive, protracted trade war.
Driven by steep unilateral import tariffs on hundreds of billions of dollars of Chinese goods.
It was a blunt force instrument used to try and force supply chains out of China.
And here's the big objective takeaway regarding China that is absolutely critical for you listening to understand.
What's that?
While Trump initiated this incredibly hardline stance on China, later administrations,
even those from the opposing political party who reversed his other domestic policies,
they largely kept this exact China stance in place. They kept the vast majority of the tariffs.
They kept the rhetoric of strategic great power competition.
They expanded restrictions on semiconductor exports, which is the ultimate proof.
Proof that this shift wasn't just the erratic whim of one disruptive president.
It was the recognition of a broader, permanent geopolitical realignment. He recognized a structural shift in the world, that China was a peer competitor, not a junior partner.
And he codified it into U.S. policy that outlasted his administration.
He fundamentally changed the trajectory of the world's most important bilateral relationship.
Okay, so let's take a breath and survey the landscape. We have a president who has completely redefined communication via Twitter.
He has declared an existential war on the traditional press.
He has hollowed out the bureaucracy and warred with his own intelligence agencies.
He has survived a historically rare impeachment proceeding that cleanly divided the country in half.
And he has rewritten the entire post-WWII global order, terrifying allies and starting a trade war with China.
It is an incredibly turbulent, exhausted baseline.
And then came 2020.
Right.
By early 2020, just as the re-election cycle was beginning to gear up, the ultimate, completely unforeseen stress test arrived.
And it violently collided with absolutely every single dynamic we've spent the last hour discussing.
We are, of course, talking about the COVID-19 pandemic.
It is the defining crisis of the end of his first term. A true, once-in-a-century black swan event.
It was an unprecedented crisis that forced the administration to juggle multiple catastrophic emergencies simultaneously.
You didn't just have a massive, rapidly spreading public health emergency with a novel, deadly virus.
This virus immediately triggered devastating economic damage as global commerce, travel, and local businesses simply froze.
This economic despair then compounded with rising social unrest and protests across the country during the summer of 2020.
And all of this layered directly on top of the deeply entrenched political divisions, the media distrust, and the institutional paranoia we just mapped out.
Let's look at how this ultimate crisis was handled, because again, the perceptions of the response are worlds apart depending on where you stood.
Right. For the supporters of the administration, what were the major successes they pointed to during this incredibly dark time?
Supporters point to monumental, genuinely historic achievements. The absolute crown jewel is Operation Warp Speed.
Oh, absolutely.
The administration poured massive federal resources into partnering with private pharmaceutical companies,
utilizing the military's logistical expertise
to develop, test, and manufacture COVID-19 vaccines at a historically unprecedented pace.
What usually takes a decade of clinical trials and red tape was done in less than a year. It was a triumph of public-private partnership.
Supporters also point to the sweeping multi-trillion-dollar economic support measures.
The direct stimulus checks mailed to citizens.
The Paycheck Protection Program loans that kept small businesses from going under. The administration championed these massive spending bills to keep the economy afloat.
Operation Warp Speed really was a moonshot level of achievement. It proved that when the red tape is cut, the scientific capacity of the U.S. is unparalleled.
It did. But if you turn to the critics' view of the pandemic response, the assessment is incredibly harsh.
What does the dossier outline there?
The heavy criticism focuses largely on the rhetoric, the communication, and the leadership style during the crisis.
Critics point to deeply contradictory messaging coming directly from the White House, right?
Yes. The president would often contradict his own top public health officials and epidemiologists during live, nationally televised press briefings.
They argue there was a severe, dangerous, and intentional underestimation of the virus's risks in the early months,
confusing the public about the severity of the threat. And most tragically, critics point to the profound politicization of basic health and safety measures.
That's the part that is still so hard to wrap your head around. Wearing a paper mask or trusting guidance from the CDC suddenly became a political loyalty test,
rather than a straightforward medical decision.
If you wore a mask, you belonged to one political tribe. If you refused, you belonged to the other.
Which brings us back to the core theme of this entire deep dive.
The big takeaway here isn't just a critique of the medical response or supply chain logistics.
No, it's that the pandemic didn't actually create new problems in American society.
Rather, it acted as a giant, terrifying magnifying glass.
Exactly. It took all the existing societal fault lines we've been tracking since 2017.
The deep distrust in the media.
The paranoia regarding government institutions and the deep state.
The hyper-partisanship, where the two sides couldn't even agree on a shared set of basic facts.
It took all of those vulnerabilities, made them painfully visible, and widened them significantly.
If half the country fundamentally believes the media is lying to them,
and half the country fundamentally believes a government bureaucracy is a corrupt deep state,
how do you possibly manage a public health crisis that requires collective, unified, nationwide action?
You can't. The pandemic was the ultimate crucible that tested this newly reshaped, highly polarized presidency.
And it revealed a nation that was profoundly struggling to find a shared reality.
It really did.
Which brings us to our conclusion as we wrap up this look at the legacy of 2017 to 2021. To synthesize everything we've pulled from Chapter 2 of the dossier today, Donald Trump didn't just change laws.
Presidents change laws, sign executive orders, and appoint judges all the time.
He fundamentally changed the expectations of what a president is, how a president acts, and what the highest office in the land actually does.
That is the undeniable objective historical fact of this era.
Whether you are listening to this and you see him as a hero who bravely challenged corrupt power structures,
or whether you see him as a dangerous threat who violently eroded democratic norms,
one thing is absolutely certain. The presidency was permanently altered.
The way future leaders communicate with the public, how they handle a hostile press corps, how they treat international allies,
how they manage their own civil servants, and how they engage their political opponents.
They will never, ever go back to the pre-2017 baseline. The mold wasn't just broken, it was shattered.
The traditional institutional filter is gone, and the smartphone is prominently in the Oval Office.
And this raises an important question. Perhaps the most important historical question of this entire period.
Was Trump simply modernizing the presidency?
Was he adapting a clunky 19th century institution for the raw, unfiltered, lightning-fast era of social media?
Where traditional diplomacy and bureaucratic memos are just too slow to be effective.
Or did his combative anti-institutional approach fatally weaken the vital constitutional guardrails that had been painstakingly built to prevent the abuse of power?
That is the massive question, and I'm leaning in to tell you this right now. The answer to that question only truly reveals itself in what happened next.
Because as chaotic, disruptive, and historic as 2017 to early 2020 was, it was only the preamble.
Chapter 3 of the dossier covering 2020 to 2029 is where the real constitutional stress test happens.
In our next deep dive, we are going to cover the explosive, contested 2020 elections.
We'll be looking at the unprecedented legal procedures that follow, the intense, dangerous clash between federal authority and state powers,
the immense pressure placed on the role of judges, and a fundamental, terrifying crisis of trust in the rule of law and election systems themselves.
And the core question we will be framing for that next deep dive is this.
Can a modern democracy actually continue to function when massive groups of its own citizens fundamentally disagree on what is true?
It's going to be a heavy one, but an absolutely essential one. Thank you so much for joining us for today's deep dive. We've covered an immense amount of ground.
We really have.
But before we go, I want to leave you with one final thought. We've spent all this time looking at how one single man changed the highest office in the land through the power of a smartphone, a populist message, and a fractured media landscape. But ask yourself this. Did the presidency change Donald Trump? Or did the office simply become a mirror reflecting exactly what the modern electorate and modern America had already become?